Hello, welcome to Illinois Radio Reader. This is Lisa bringing you the News Gazette today, March 11th, 2026. It's Wednesday, and today's paper has a very large picture of the Edison Middle School girls basketball players. There's three girls and there's three boys pictured in this colorful picture here. It says, this week, Champaign Edison Middle School will open its gym doors so out-of-town IHSA Final Four teams can get shots up before game day at State Farm Center. One day, the Comets hope they'll get the same opportunity to play at the state finals. And then we are going to continue on with that story. It says here, for me, there's no better time of year. By Lee Hall. And there's a picture provided. When I was asked to write a column for the News Gazette on my IHSA State Basketball Finals memories, I anticipated your questions. Who is this guy and why should we care? Well, I have an answer for the first part anyway. I'm Lee Hall. I'm a 33-year-old sportscaster / sports director at Week TV in Peoria, a 30-plus-year veteran of the IHSA TV network. As sideline reporter and play-by-play announcer, you might not remember me, but my bright blue sport coat was well-known and a member of the Illinois Basketball Coaches Association Hall of Fame. I just joined the parent company of the News Gazette as a media marketing consultant in January, but they know about my past life in sports and were kind enough to give me an outlet. My first memories of watching the IHSA Boys Basketball State Finals go way back to 1973, when my mom Clara's hometown, Ridgeway, went to the Class A Elite Eight at the building formerly known as the Assembly Hall. I had no idea as a 10-year-old that this was only the second Class A state tournament in IHSA history, or, what a revolutionary idea, Chuck Rawlinski, a man I know as a sportscaster 20 years later, had introduced to our basketball-rich state. Hebron had made a name for small school basketball giant killers, a la Hoosiers back in the 1950s, but Chuck wanted to offer an opportunity for more of the little guys to win regional championships, as the story goes. He got it done, and a new tradition was born. I remember watching the games on our little 19-inch black and white TV that year, and little did I know how much my life would intertwine with that tournament, or what these small-town kids were accomplishing. Looking back, I was reminded that the Ridgeway Eagles beat St. Anne in the state semifinals. That team was led by Jack Sigma, who would choose Illinois Wesleyan University over the University of Illinois due to the recruiting of legendary coach Denny Bridges. Sigma would become a first-round NBA draft pick of the Seattle Supersonics, win an NBA championship with them, and become a member of the Basketball Hall of Fame. Pretty good for a bunch of kids from rural community tucked away in southeastern Illinois, about 40 miles west of Evansville, Indiana, and best known at the time as the popcorn capital of the world. Ridgeway's Brent Browning outscored Sigma in the tournament 105-100 and was named the all-tournament team, as the unranked Eagles beat Maple Park Caneland 54-51 in the championship game. Almost 40 years later, a gentleman from Ridgeway who had heard me reference that team numerous times in my telecast introduced me to their longtime coach, Bob Dallas, at the tournament in Peoria. For a moment, I was taken back to those black and white TV days of my childhood, meeting a man who was a giant in my mind. While it was cool having the IHSA tournament in my hometown and backyard, I grew up dreaming of playing in the Assembly Hall, just like every other kid, basketball-loving child in the state back in those days. I remember watching Lawrenceville's Jay Schidler weave his offensive magic and then going outside to try to recreate it myself on our driveway hoop. When Peoria Richwoods went to state in 1975, it was a thrill to see my hometown guys play in the hall, led by future Illini players Derek Holcomb, Kevin Westervelt, and Mark Smith. I didn't know it then, but Bloomington's Bob Bender played in that Elite Eight, too. And I would later cover his Illinois State teams and host the Bob Bender's Coach Show. While I was soaking up all that IHSA history, too much to mention in one column, I had no idea how it would course through my veins and continue to influence my life to this very day. On Monday night, I called a Richwood's Super Sectional game on the NFHS network. The Knights were led by the 9th-ranked guard in the nation, Amarion Smith-Holly, who just happens to have a scholarship offer from the U of I. He didn't make it to State Farm Center this year, but like this reporter over 40 years ago, he has those dreams of playing on that floor and hoisting a state championship trophy someday. Four teams in four classes will realize those dreams this weekend and make memories that will stay with them for a lifetime. Let's continue on with our front page with an article from Champaign by Luke Taylor with the heading, Council Unanimously OK Settlement Requiring Demolition. This is about the Champaign Park apartments. The Champaign City Council has unanimously approved a settlement that will see the Champaign Park apartments complex demolished no later than May of 2027. This has been years of work, Mayor Deb Finan said at Tuesday's brief meeting, where the settlement vote was the only action taken on the agenda. It was work in caring for the people that lived there. It was work in building our case. She thanks city employees who were involved in dealing with issues at the complex, as well as those who worked behind the scenes on legal issues. Thank you for getting us to the point where we could accept the settlement, Finan said. Now that the agreement has been approved by the council, it will be filed in Champaign County Circuit Court for a judge's signature. The city, the complex owner, Champaign Apartments Owner, LLC, the mortgagee, Metropolitan Commercial Bank, and other entities were all included as parties to the settlement. Problems at the complex first arose in 2022, according to a report by the council by City Attorney Thomas Yu, when boiler failures left hundreds of residents in frigid weather without heat. The buildings ended up being condemned, but remained standing. In July of 2025, the city was approved to vacate remaining residents, who numbered between 10 and 50. The 29 abandoned buildings had also been the site of multiple structure fires, at least one of which was determined to be the result of unsafe use of electricity. The city had previously sought injunctions to force Champaign Apartment Owners LLC to make repairs and pay fines for numerous violations of building codes or demolish the building. You wrote that as of January, the city has incurred over $430,000 in litigation costs. The proposed settlement states that the involved parties seek to avoid the risks, burdens, and expenses of further litigation. The settlement also says all parties in agreement that the property is in disrepair and must be demolished. Under the settlement, Metropolitan Commercial Bank will arrange a sale from Champaign Apartments Owner, LLC, to a third party that must apply for a demolition permit by October 13th and begin work by December 4th. If those deadlines aren't met, you wrote that the city would be authorized to take steps to carry out the demolition. The settlement also includes other deadlines. At least 10 buildings must be demolished by February 12th of 2027. Then at least 20 buildings must be torn down by March 12th of 2027. All buildings, accessory structures, and parking lots must be demolished and excavated by May 15th of 2027. And the final article on the front page is from the Champaign County Board by Jana Wersima from Urbana. Sheriff shares concerns about overtime budgeting. Over the past 4 years, the Champaign County Sheriff's Office has annually spent an average of about $411,000 on overtime, Sheriff Dustin Huerman said. However, the funds budgeted for overtime during that span ranged from about $225,000 in fiscal year 2022 to $275,000 in fiscal year of 2025. If we are wanting to budget most appropriately, my suggestion is to budget at the average amount, Huerman told the News Gazette. This would at least get us closer to the exact and expected amount. The agenda for the County Board's Tuesday committee off the whole meeting included a report from Huerman on his department's overtime costs, which he said he feels the county is consistently under budgeting. The sheriff emphasized that he is not asking for more money and is instead trying to better plan for and allocate personnel resources that we are already using. We are already spending the money. I just feel it is most appropriate to invest that money in full-time resources to reduce overtime, or at the least, better budget overtime for what we have historically spent, knowing that we will likely continue to be over budget if we don't, Huerman said. The total amount spent on overtime for law enforcement in the fiscal year of 2025 was about $455,000, Huerman said. This included a little under $140,000 for about 2,240 hours of holiday overtime and about $126,000 for roughly 2,170 hours of mandatory holdover overtime. Per his report to the County Board's Finance Committee Chair, Ellie Hanauer Friedman. In regards to the latter category, Huerman explained that the union contract requires a minimum number of deputies and correctional officers to be on duty each shift. If that minimum number isn't met, which can be due to a variety of reasons like being sick, we have to call back appropriate employees to fill in. He said in an email, this can throw an unexpected wrench into family time and other downtime needed to recharge for the next shift. The more overtime that is required, especially in corrections, the more often employees will call in sick, which then creates the need for additional overtime in an already stressful job. According to Huerman, overtime costs for corrections totaled about $588,000 in fiscal year 2025, including $383,000 for 2,220 hours of mandatory holdover overtime and $191,000 for 3,110 hours of holiday overtime. He noted that the county board previously responded to his concerns in the fall by authorizing additional correctional officer positions to help reduce overtime. He said that recruitment for these spots has been very challenging, but his office is trying to fill the roles as soon as possible. The sheriff's office currently has 57 authorized sworn positions. Huerman said that this includes his own, as well as those of the chief deputy, the captain, and three lieutenants. I have one deputy on permanent light duty due to an on-duty traffic clash a couple of years ago. One deputy on light duty who's recovering from a traffic crash. One deputy who has been on military leave for the last few years. We have to hold his position for 5 years of active duty. And two vacant deputy positions for which we are currently interviewing, he said, adding that two deputies are on extended leave because their family members are experiencing serious medical issues. Deputies serve in 12-hour shifts, Huerman said. He estimated that in order to make a large dent in overtime, his department would need four additional deputies, one for each shift. However, even with additional staffing, overtime would not be entirely eliminated, he noted, citing factors such as deputies needing to complete training that cannot be done while on work, or on working holidays or duties. Huerman stated that it is important to facilitate a good work-life balance for deputies and correctional officers so they are less stressed and have a better mindset while working. This helps them to make better decisions in their roles and makes them less likely to use excessive force, he said. Maintaining this balance also helps us keep employees instead of leaving for other positions with other organizations. We try very hard to reduce overtime required, but sometimes it's unavoidable. Tuesday's committee of the whole agenda also includes a proposed ordinance to increase the number of authorized deputy positions by one, which would bring the total number of authorized sworn positions up to 58. Huerman explained that this is related to the Village of Savoy's contract with his office for law enforcement services. As part of that contract, three full-time deputies are assigned to patrol that village, he wrote. After discussions with the Village of Savoy on an upcoming contract renewal, it has been mutually decided to add a fourth deputy to the contract. As with the other three deputy positions, this fourth deputy position will be fully reimbursed by the Village of Savoy. We are adding the extra deputy, as this will give us a full 24/7 coverage, 365 days a year, said Savoy Village Administrator Andy Kornstrom. Currently, on some days when staffing is tight, the sheriff doesn't have a deputy in the village, but they would be responding from other parts of the county should a response be needed. This is essentially improving protection spurred only by growth and not by an increase of crime or issues. No formal action is taken at Committee on the Whole meetings. Let's continue on in our communities with some local news. This is in Chicago. U.S. District Court in Chicago. Man gets 10 years for $14 million fraud tied to COVID-19 loans. A South Suburban man was sentenced to 10 years in federal prison Tuesday in a massive $14 million fraud scheme where he collected kickbacks for filing more than 1,500 bogus loan applications at the height of the COVID-19 pandemic. The 120-month term handed down to Sharhabil Shrete was believed to be the longest sentence for any case in U.S. District Court in Chicago related to the country's Paycheck Protection Program, which funded emergency loans designed to give financial relief to small business owners and others during the pandemic, but became a hotbed of fraud and abuse. Shrete, 46, buried his face in his hands and wept after U.S. District Judge Martha Pacold announced the sentence, which was at the top of the federal sentencing guidelines and more than three times higher than what the defense requested. Earlier in the two-hour meeting, Shrete, a tax preparer who lives in Crete, apologized to the court and his family for the harm he did. "I don't know what to say or do now," Shrete said. "It's so harming for everyone. I'm speechless." Pacold acknowledged that her sentence was on the high end, but she said she found the level of fraud perpetrated by Shrete to be staggering. According to Assistant U.S. Attorney Ellie Zenner, Shrete submitted more than 1,500 false PPP loan applications on behalf of at least 1,025 clients beginning in 2020, causing some $14 million of funds to be dispersed, most of which was forgiven by the U.S. government. In return, Shrete received about $740,000 in kickbacks from clients, spending it on luxury vacations and expensive home renovations, Zenner wrote in a recent sentencing memo. He also sent hundreds of thousands of dollars to his second wife in his native Palestine, where he built a luxury second home and purchased a Mercedes, according to Zenner. Then we have an article. And now an article closer to home from the University of Illinois Police, unofficial, no busier than any other weekend this time of year, by Luke Taylor. What was once the biggest party weekend on campus came and went in expected peace this year, University of Illinois Police said. Unofficial St. Patrick's Day was launched by campus town bar owners in the mid-1990s to allow students to celebrate the holiday on the first weekend in March. Since the actual St. Patrick's Day tends to fall during the university, it's been known for massive parties, green-clad college students roaming the streets, overconsumption, and ultimately increased arrest rates. It used to take place. It falls during the spring break. Not so in recent years. For the last few years, unofficial has not been much different than a typical weekend, said U of I police spokesperson Abigail Reisner. Home football games, especially against Big Ten opponents, and weekends around Halloween have resulted in more calls for service than we received this past weekend. Both U of I and Champaign police provide enforcement across campus town and the overall area during unofficial. While Reisner couldn't account for any Champaign police statistics, she said her department issued 12 notices to appear for offenses, including minor. in possession of alcohol, noise violations, and possession of alcohol on public property. The department also made arrests for driving under the influence and battery inside a campus bar. Reisner said that make the weekend no busier than any other weekend with warming weather in the spring semester. We did, however, have extra staff in campus town, and we believe the additional visibility helps keep the weekend and any significant issues at bay. And there is a picture here by Luke Taylor with unofficial St. Patrick's Day revelers hamming it up for the camera as they wait to cross Green Street at the First Street on March 6th at the University of Illinois campus. Let's head over to the opinion section with a J. Mark Powell piece in his Holy Cow History entitled The Queen Who Saved Britain's Monarchy, and included is a beautiful, elegant picture of Mary of Teck, Queen of the United Kingdom and Empress of India, as the wife of George V. It's been a rocky road for Britain's House of Windsor as of late. Ever since the end of World War II, it has wobbled dangerously close to the cliff's edge of abolition, only to catch a breather and soldier on. Currently, it's the alleged antics, illegal and unamusing, of Andrew Mountbatten Windsor, the royal, formerly known as Prince Andrew, that are putting the monarchy back on the endangered species list. Given that March is Women's History Month, the current scandal provides the perfect opportunity to revisit the tale of how one woman single-handedly kept the royal family on the throne. That woman just happened to wear a diamond tiara. Talk about being born with a silver spoon in your mouth. Mary of Teck seemed destined for royal greatness from the moment she was born in 1867 in the same room in Kensington Palace where her first cousin, Queen Victoria, had been born 48 years and 2 days earlier. Born Victoria Mary Augusta Louise Olga Pauline Claudine Agnes, to her family she was May, nicknamed for the bright and sunny month of her arrival. A bright and sunny girl, her childhood, although happy, was strict. From the moment she learned to walk, she was groomed to move elegantly through the highest levels of Britain's aristocracy. That preparation paid off in 1891 when she became engaged to Prince Albert Victor. He was second in line to become king, the position young Prince George holds today. However, the prince died in a global pandemic just 6 weeks later. Queen Victoria and the Prince of Wales didn't want to let this prize get away, so they persuaded Albert Victor's brother, Prince George, to marry her instead. After they tied the knot in 1893, royal watchers were stunned by what came next. The couple were genuinely happy together and developed a deep bond. The prince became King George V on May the 6th of 1910, and his wife was now styled Mary of Teck, Queen of the United Kingdom and British Dominions, and Empress of India. You'll know Queen Mary, if you've seen the hit TV series The Crown or the Academy Award-winning 2010 film The King's Speech. Both portrayed her exactly as she was in life, coldly strict, emotionally remote, and personally intimidating. Britons of the time appreciated her devotion to duty. They respected her, but they didn't love her. However, George V did, and that's what all that mattered. Their lives ran smoothly until World War I erupted, and Queen Mary was among the first to sense that the global conflict posed a clear and present danger to what insiders called the firm, the British royal family, and the organizational machinery that supports it. There was a delicious irony in the predicament. George V, the man who symbolically led Great Britain in its fight against Germany, came from a German family, a very German family, in fact. When the Great War, as World War I was called at the time, began, the sovereign was head of the House of Saxe-Coburg and Gotha. Coburg. German royals had married into the British monarchy for centuries. In fact, the English royals often spoke German among themselves in private. George V was even the first cousin of his Teutonic rival, Kaiser Wilhelm II. That posed a serious problem in London. British wartime propaganda had skillfully whipped up a frenzied hatred of all things Germanic. It was greatly aided in its work by the Kaiser, who had once urged his soldiers to act like the vicious barbarians led by Attila the Hun in the 5th century. The Allies promptly labeled their German enemies the Hun, and anything even remotely associated with him, including beer, sausage, and sauerkraut, was verboten. Queen Mary sensed danger. With anti-German sentiment spreading, it was only a matter of when and not if it would reach Buckingham Palace. Her husband remained unmoved. She slowly but steadily worked on him until she eventually won him over to her way of thinking. And in July of 1917, George V issued a royal decree. From that moment on, the House of Saxe-Coburg and Gotha was gone, replaced by the House of Windsor, a name taken from the family's beloved Windsor Castle solely because it sounded English. Britons enthusiastically cheered the change. In Berlin, Cousin Wilhelm sneered, saying he looked forward to attending a performance of the Merry Wives of Saxe-Gotha-Coburg, a mocking reference to Shakespeare's The Merry Wives of Windsor. However, Mary Tuck had the last laugh. With 16 months, Wilhelm and his House of Hohenzollern had lost the throne in Germany. The same happened to the Tsar's House of Romanov in Russia and the Emperor's House of Habsburg in Austria-Hungary. While the Windsors survived, as for Queen Mary, a world-famous ocean liner, a battleship, and even a university were named in her honor, all because she had the steel-eyed calculation to spot a threat at the outset and the courage to neutralize it before it metastasized. Let's go to Mahomet in Section A8 for an article about America's best restaurants. Mahomet Restaurant Basks in National Spotlight by Jana Wersima. A local restaurant has been around for nearly a decade, was recently highlighted by America's Best Restaurants, a media firm that highlights independent eateries across the country. The ABR Roadshow episode on Project 47 Smokehouse, located at 101 North Lombard Street, can be viewed on the restaurant's Facebook page. We're hoping to see more and more traffic come in from people that maybe haven't tried us out, said owner Justin Taylor. There's a few people that came in that actually live locally and were like, we've lived here, we just have never come in. So that's good too. Out-of-town people are great, but getting the people that live around here that haven't tried us before or have maybe come in a long time ago, haven't been back in a while, getting them to come in again to try us out is always nice. He learned that the restaurant was going to be featured in early 2025. ABR Roadshow episodes are shared on Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, and other platforms. This isn't just a one-time video, it's a marketing powerhouse. The firm's website states, we create 100-plus pieces of social media content from your episode, keeping your restaurant in front of local customers long after filming. During the episode on Project 47 Smokehouse, which was filmed in November and released last week, host Amanda Valentine tastes 3 featured menu items and learns more about the restaurant from Taylor. And there's a picture included here. Project 47 Smokehouse staff Rafael Aguilar, Jackie Holt, Justin Taylor, Jessica Wettig, and Sergio Aguilar pose with the America's Best Restaurant van. The barbecue platter was one of 3 menu items featured on the roadshow. In addition to barbecue, the restaurant serves flatbreads, sandwiches, burgers, and a Sunday brunch menu. We wanted to make sure we had a good variety because we do have a lot of families in this town, and we wanted to make sure that everybody in the family would have something that they would like on the menu, Taylor says during the ABR Roadshow episode. Other area restaurants featured on the show include Buford's Pub in Sadorus, Corner Beehive in Villa Grove, prior to its September 24th closure, Yoder's Kitchen in Arthur, and Gilbert Street Cafe in Danville. Smith Burger Company of Champaign-Urbana announced in January that it will be joining the club. Co-owner Drew Smith expects ABR Roadshow to film its episode late this summer. And I'm going to take a break now. We will return with the second half of the News Gazette. See you in a minute.